welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 137. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we are looking at a couple of movies from the 40s and the 50s. The one from the 1950s is a movie starring Anthony Franciosa and Dean Martin called Career. And the one from the 40s comes right from the end of the 40s. It's a 1949 movie called Black Magic, starring Orson Welles as Count Cagliostro. There's also news about a big Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In podcast project that I've started. And there's feedback, and there's also a little bit about what I've been watching. So sit back, relax, and we'll get on with the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old. And secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Hello, how is everybody? We're doing fine here. It's winter. It sucks. Well, I'll leave that one aside for now. I have been fairly busy doing all sorts of weird and wonderful things. Last weekend, it was a long weekend here, so I had 3.5 days at the National Science Fiction Convention, Continuum 10, where I caught up with enormous amounts of wonderful people, friends from all across Australia, were there any from overseas? Not this time around, but it would have been nice to get some friends from overseas, but I had to make do with the ones that are somewhere between Tasmania and North Queensland and Western Australia and Sydney. But we hung out a lot. I did a panel. I was supposed to do two, but the timing didn't quite work for me. So I did a panel on podcasting, how to do it, why we do it, and all that kind of thing with a group of very interesting people, including Alex Pierce, with whom I had a discussion about Timothy Dalton as James Bond, just on the side. I'm going to put in the show notes a link to Alex's blog, where she's reviewing from a feminist viewpoint all of the James Bond films. She's just got past the Roger Moore ones, which is the hard part, I suppose. But given that the last Paleo Cinema was about Dalton as Bond, I thought I'd let you know about that and send you the link. She also talks about a lot of other things too. It's not just about the James Bond films. And so I had a chat with her, had a chat with a bunch of other people, and I came up with an idea. And the idea is this. There's a service called Patreon, which enables podcasters and other creative types to offer people who listen to their output or view it if they're an actor or something. Well, I'm not explaining this well. So what it is, I'm going to put up a link. And if you choose to, and this is entirely optional, you can subscribe to the podcast and pay $1 per month to do so. Now, this is entirely optional. Nobody's going to lose anything by not doing it. That's one of the things I really wanted to do with this Patreon thing. So if you there are a few different levels you can subscribe at. Now, again, really optional. The first one is the $1 one, where you get debited $1 a month from your PayPal or something like that, and it goes, part of it goes to Patreon, but part of it goes to me as well to cover the costs of the podcast. And if you, the reward for doing a $1 a month subscription is you get a credit on the podcast. So you get to be, you know how the movies have weird credits at the end of them, like Best Boy and Key Grip and Foley Artist. Foley Artist is taken, by the way, and I'll explain why in a moment. I'm going to give you a credit at the end of the podcast forever. I've got to think up a title for you, which I'm willing to negotiate on, but Foley Artist is taken. And you then get a credit at the end of the show into the indefinite future. That's for the $1 a month. The $2 a month one, you also get to pick one of the movies that I talk about on the podcast. Doesn't matter what kind, as long as it's still within the Paleo Cinema thing, which is more than 20 years old, if you subscribe for $2 a month, you get to pick one of the films. And I'm hoping nobody picks The Nun Story or something like that, something really horrible. But there's always a possibility, and I'm willing to take the risk on that. The $5 a month one, which is for millionaires only, I suppose, lets you not only pick a movie, but you get to talk about it on the podcast with me. Now, some people would not see that as a reward, but with the way these Patreon things work, you've got to escalate the rewards. And the reward is you get to come on the show via Skype. You've got to have Skype. And have a chat with me about the movie you selected. I'll pick the other movie. I'll make sure you get a copy of it, and we'll shoot the shit about that film. I don't have anything above the $5 one, but I had a chat with Morris. Morris from over at Love That Album. Morris said, I just want to give you some money one off. So here's what I worked out with Morris that's possible. You pay the money as the first month. You can change the amount on the subscription on the Patreon page, and I'm going to send that link on the show notes. And in case you're writing it down, it's Patreon, patreon.com/paleocinema, lowercase one word, no dashes. So Morris said, I want to pay a one-off amount because I like your podcast. So what Morris is going to do is he's going to put in the amount he wants to give me into the subscription part, and then cancel the subscription after the first month, which means that he then gets to do a one-off payment. So you can do it that way as well. It's entirely up to you. Now, the reason I'm doing this is this. There's a couple of reasons, really. The first one is it cost me money to host two of the two podcasts. So that works out at about $200 a year. I know it's not a lot of money, but one of the things I thought I'd do, try to do it anyway, is to make the podcast revenue neutral. So if I get above what I need for the hosting, there are a couple of things I'm going to do with money. The first one is I want to get some software called Dragon Voice 10, which allows me to do transcriptions of the podcast. So I'll be able to transcribe them all into text, and I'm putting them together. Remember how about a year and a half ago I was talking about doing a paleo cinema book? Well, the plan is to go back over the old podcasts, transcribe them into text, edit the hell out of them because they will need editing, and from there put together an ebook of paleo cinema and Martian Drive-In movies. It's a long-term project, but it's something that I'd really like to do, and I'd like to have something tangible there to say I did this. So I'm going to do that. That's the plan. If I get more than that, every cent I get will go to one of two things. Either it will go to upgrading my equipment, or I will be subscribing to other Patreon podcasts. So basically giving back to the podcast community in some way. And I'll let everybody know up front what that is. I'm not going to, I've got to have real transparency on this. It's not an optional thing for me. I want to make sure that I'm being very, very honest and very, very upfront with everybody who chooses. And again, it's a choice to subscribe to the podcast in a monetary form. Now, this may fall on its ass. I don't mind if it does. I've already got $3 a month coming in because two people have subscribed already. Now, one of them is Tansy Rayner Roberts, a very fine Australian speculative fiction writer who did a panel at Continuum about these kind of Kickstarter, crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, whatever you want to call them, things. And Tansy subscribed for $1, and she got the credit of being the Foley artist. So she gets to do things like this in the podcast in a purely imaginary way. So Tansy is a Foley artist, and you can go and read her blog, which is about all sorts of weird and wonderful things, and I'll spell this out for you. It's TANSYRR.com, and I'll put it in the show notes as well, because it was very kind of Tansy to be the first person to subscribe to the podcast. Now, I also got another subscription by a guy called Christopher, whom I'm not familiar with. Now, get in touch with me, Christopher, because you get to pick one of the movies of which I speak in Paleo Cinema Podcast, and I'd really like for you to get in touch with me so I can give you that reward. So anyway, that's about it for what I've been doing. I've got to tell you. I went to a bar with a female friend of mine called Jane. And she also is a writer, Jane Routley. And so we go to this bar, and it's called State of Grace. So we wander into the bar, and to the left there's a small restaurant, to the right there's a small bar. Straight ahead, there's the doors to the toilets. So Jane leads me through the doors to the toilets, and there's a little anteroom before you get to the second door, which goes through the toilets, which has bookcases on it. So she walks up to the bookcase on the right, pulls on the volume of Moby Dick in the bookcase, and a wall of bookcases slides aside, and there's a secret bar downstairs at this place called the State of Grace in Collins Street in Melbourne. So we go downstairs, and there is this very, very cool bar down there. It's got deer head on the wall. It's got bottles up behind the bar. It's got ratty old, very comfortable couches and a Phantom of the Opera pinball machine, and it's got lots of old busted stereo equipment stuck on the walls. And the drinks are a reasonable price, and there's some really nice bar food, including my all-time favourite food at the moment, croque monsieur. So Jane and I had a couple of drinks down there and grabbed some bar food. They had some halloumi with honey and figs and all sorts of groovy stuff like that. And I really fell in love with the place. It's a lovely bar, and I love the fact that it's got a secret entrance to it. So having said that, going to take a break now. Then I'm going to get back with what I've been watching, and then we'll talk about the two movies, which are from 1959, Korea, starring Tony Franciosa and Dean Martin, and from 1949, Black Magic, starring Orson Welles. That music is the theme to a TV series I've never seen called Tight Rabbits from 1959 to 1960, and it starred Mike Connors, who was later on in Mannix. And it says here, Mike Connors starred as an undercover agent named Nick, who was assigned to infiltrate criminal gangs. So that's it. I kind of like those turn of the 1950s, 1960s TV themes, because they have bongo drums in the background and they all sound very groovy, and there's just a vibe to them that I really do appreciate. Things like that one and the theme to Hawaiian Eye, I really groove on and have a stupidly exaggerated fondness for. So what have I been watching? I haven't been watching a lot of stuff that isn't genre, but I'll go through the stuff that I have. Liz and I did the radio gig again, the ABC local Radio Darwin thing, and we did Rocky Horror Picture Show, which was a lot of fun, and we had some anecdotes about that, talked it through, talked through the actors, talked through the creation of it, talked through Jim Sharman, the director's family, who did boxing tent shows in Australia from the 1940s to the 1970s. All that kind of stuff we covered really nicely, and that was a lot of fun. We were both on the same page but having slightly different viewpoints on it. Nonetheless, had a great time doing it. There was another film that I saw. Everyone, Sal had just seen The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, the Ben Stiller version. And so I thought I would revisit the Danny Kaye one, because Ben Stiller is not an actor of whom I have much fondness. So I rewatched the Danny Kaye one. I'd forgotten the fact that Boris Karloff was one of the main villains in that, and is just tearing the scenery down and having a great time with it. And I really enjoyed it for that reason. I don't think that the Danny Kaye part was as strong as it was in later films like The Court Jester and things like that. I don't think it was quite as good as that, but it was a good, fun little film, very much in the 1940s style. Danny Kaye did a couple of those nice patter songs that were written by his wife, Sylvia Fine. And yeah, it wasn't a waste of time at all, so I thought I'd stay with that kind of middle-of-the-road, very mainstream comedy things. And I'd heard something about Hugh Jackman was going to be bouncing at the Tony Awards, which he did. He bounced for 5 minutes up in the air, which is a direct homage to the next film that I saw called Small Town Girl, which ostensibly starred Farley Granger and Jane Powell, but features this really long sequence of Bobby Van bouncing through a town because he's happy and, you know, he's in love and all that kind of thing, and doing a whole bunch of different things as he bounces through the town amongst the people. So I enjoyed that. And there's another good dance sequence that Bobby Van does by himself in a small department store, which is very worth seeing. Apart from that, it's a kind of middle of the road, not too impressive movie, but those two sequences and the kind of enthusiasm and energy that Bobby Van brought to the dancing really made it work. The movie itself, Small Town Girl, was a remake of a 1930s movie, and it looks like they haven't updated it. They've tried to kind of keep the 1930s style post-production code innocence about it, and I don't think it really worked as well. But, yeah, it was worth seeing and worth remembering how much fun those two dance sequences were. Then I went on to some kind of pre-millennial disaster porn movie by seeing Dante's Peak with Linda Hamilton and Pierce Brosnan about a town up around south of Seattle somewhere with a giant volcanic peak outside it. The volcano goes up, there's pyroclastic flows and acid lakes and people getting roasted in hot springs and all sorts of fun things like that. And it holds up okay. I mean, it was one of those tentpole movies of the time where they were combining digital effects with a lot of practical effects. But, yeah, it wasn't a waste of time, really. It was nice fun revisiting it. And the script, maybe on the people side of things, was a little light and underwritten. But it was always good to watch those people in the little aluminium dinghy trying to get across a lake that's turned to acid. All that kind of stuff. That one's done very well. That particular sequence is really nicely paced, and the escalation of the menace is done quite well in it. And I think that's probably the best bit in the movie for that point of view. There is a bit too where they've got to drive across a lava flow, because this particular volcano has every different kind of volcano in it for some reason. But that doesn't really have as much of menace and as much at stake as the taking the boat across the river, the Lake of Acid thing does. The only other thing I've really seen is I rewatched for the first time since it came out Brian De Palma's Blowout, starring John Travolta and Nancy Allen. And yeah, it's very much in the style of conspiracy thrillers of about a decade beforehand, and of necessity, the characters in the movie have to be a little more naive than maybe a modern cinema audience is about these things. But Travolta's kind of odd in this film. I'm not sure what it is, but maybe the character's supposed to be a bit off, because obviously there is an aspect to the character as the film ends where you see that he is a little bit fucked up more than you thought he was for most of the movie. But nonetheless, the Palmer's part of it was really a good action thriller. There's a few bravura moments. There's another... I talked about the Fury in a couple of Martian Driving podcasts ago and mentioned how that De Palma had been taught by a cinematographer to use what's called split diopters, which is a thing where the camera gets a special lens put on it, which makes one half of it nearsighted and the other half long-sighted. So wherever you want to have the dividing line between the diopters, you can have something in really good foreground close-up while something else is in really clear background close-up on the other side of the screen. And De Palma uses that a lot in this movie. To great effect, yes, but now that I know about split diopters, and you might want to look that up on Wikipedia, because it is quite interesting how they did it. These days you do it digitally, you don't need to worry about that. But in the old days of film cinema, where people did expose film to make cinema, it was something that really was a way to tell a story slightly differently and to use both sides of the screen to tell two different parts of the story. So I was particularly aware of that, and I really did like it for that reason. I've forgotten that John Lithgow was the villain too, which was kind of fun. A very young and lean, with slightly more hair version of himself. I remember him in All That Jazz as well, playing the guy brought in to replace Joe Gideon. And I'm going to have to rewatch The World According to Garp because I kind of like that as well. Though I think Robin Williams is problematic in that movie, where, but like John Lithgow plays a transsexual person. So there is that to go back. So I'll put that on my list of things to rewatch at some stage. But that's about it from what I've watched of mainstream cinema, in a sense. But anyway, I'm going to take a break in a moment. And when I get back, we're going to talk about the first of the two movies. When it was made, it was called Cagliostro. But people know it better, the 1949 movie, directed by Gregory Ratoff, starring Orson Welles, called Black Magic.
It's a lonely night in Paris. Where's my love of yesterday? The Rue Saint-Honoré, where once we had walked together, seems as bleak as a sidewalk cafe in cold rainy weather. It's a lonely night in Paris. Gay Paris is not so gay. C'est la vie is gone, and gone are the dreams we might have known. It's a lonely night in Paris, and I'm alone. It's a lonely night in Paris. Gay Paris is not so gay. C'est la vie is gone, and gone are the dreams we might have known. It's a lonely night in Paris, and I'm alone. So
that was Lonely Night in Paris by Julie London. And I know our friend Morris from Love That Album podcast is a big Julie London fan, so I thought they'd play that for him. And please, if you like the song, buy it. I did. I've got it on CD. But anyway, on to Count Cagliostro, played by Orson Welles in the 1949 movie Black Magic, also known as Cagliostro. Orson Welles was having a rough time in the late 1940s. His marriage to Rita Hayworth broke up around the time he made The Lady from Shanghai. He was in Italy doing things. He really was at a bit of a loose end. His marriage hadn't been a happy one. He was monogamous with Rita Hayworth for a very long time, as a percentage of their marriage. But she was jealous. She really did have a few problems and accused him of things that he hadn't done. That's according to Barbara Leeming's biography, Orson Welles. Now, that may or may not be true with Orson Welles. Like with Count Cagliostro, the actual real-life historical character, it's a little hard to get the true facts. Here's what I think we know. Orson Welles was not a bad-looking guy in his day. If you have a look at him in Black Magic, he's in pretty good shape. He's not skinny, but he's not the Orson Welles we know from things like Touch of Evil. The 1950s were not kind to Orson Welles' health. But in 1949, he decided to do this film in Italy called Cagliostro, otherwise known as Black Magic. And so he undertook to do fencing lessons. He had a few sword fighting scenes. He took some fencing lessons. He also had another form of exercise, in that there was a 21-year-old actress called Marilyn Monroe with whom he had an affair at the time while she was still an unknown. So things weren't entirely bad, but you know, the marriage had broken up and Welles was upset about that and not at his best. So he took up the offer of doing black magic. He did the fencing lessons. He went to Scalina Studios in Rome and made the movie. A guy who later on turned up again in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil was doing the film as well, an actor called Akim Tamarov, who was born in Tbilisi, Georgia, and died in Palm Springs, which shows you the arc of Akim Tamarov's career. He was a good jobbing actor. He did character parts. He was always played slimy, oleaginous characters, and he was playing the uncle of Joseph Balsamo, a.k.a. Count Cagliostro. Akim Tamarov, interesting history. His wife was in quite a famous movie that I've got a little bit of fondness for. Her name was Tamara Shane, and she played Al Jolson's mum in The Jolson Story. Even the director of this film, Gregory Ratoff, who was known as both an actor and a director, we've seen in other things. In fact, I've talked about a movie that he was in Paleo Cinema Podcast before. He played Max Fabian, the producer, in All About Eve. He has a couple of scenes with Marilyn Monroe. See, it all goes around and comes around. Everybody's tied up with each other like a rat king. So, yeah, so that's it. Gregory Ratoff, interesting guy, both acted and directed. And this film I kind of like as well. Orson Welles is hypnotic, and he gets to do little bits of sleight of hand and stage magic, which was a great fondness of Welles. If you have a look at a lot of stuff he did in the 1940s, he did a lot of USO tours and a lot of benefits for the soldiers during World War II, doing magic acts on stage and delighting audiences and raising funds that way. So it was very much one of Welles' great love. And he getting to play the ultimate charlatan, whose identity is pretty much unknown, as the real-life Joseph Balsamo was. He made a lot of claims about his upbringing, about his noble birth and things like that, but the consensus of opinion, and by the way, he didn't end well. He did die of capital punishment, in a sense. But the consensus of opinions is he was a bullshit artist. He really did invent himself out of whole cloth and was not what he claimed to be. And this is, of course, is a perfect role for Orson Welles for that reason. I'll play a little bit of a grab of Count Cagliostro, a.k.a. Joseph Balsamo, at the start of his career in this movie, where he hooks up with Dr. Anton Mesmer, the guy who invented mesmerism, hypnotism. Cagliostro was a natural hypnotist, and one of Mesmer's patients is an elderly nobleman suffering from palsy, and Cagliostro decides he's going to cure this man of the shakes and the palsy that he has with hypnosis. And there's this great scene of Welles with his large hypnotic eyes and his big mustache and his especially curly hair, hypnotizing this guy into not having the shakes anymore.
Look me in the eyes.
Forget your palsy. Your palsy. New life. New life. He's coursing up your limbs, up your arms, up your legs. New life, new life, new life.
Your head stopped shaking already, Baron. You can feel new life stealing up through your legs, through your arms, down your hand.
They're shaking less and less and less and less until they're absolutely still, still.
See for yourself.
As I said, it's a perfect role for Welles as the showman. The movie is based on a novel by Alexandre Dumas. The interesting thing is there's a little bit of a frame around this movie where Dumas, father and son, are talking about Joseph Balsamo and how he's got to write this novel about Joseph Balsamo. The interesting thing there is that the father is played by a character actor called Barry Kroger, and the son is played by Raymond Burr in an early role, which is kind of interesting. The other interesting thing I found out about it is that Barry Kroger, even though his Dumas has curly hair, he's not played as his correct race because Alexandre Dumas, as we know from Christoph Waltz telling us in Django Unchained, was a man of colour, which is kind of interesting, the fact that they didn't go there and didn't use that as a part of the movie. But nonetheless, it's an interesting film. There is actually a 2007 movie called Fade to Black, which relates to this movie strongly. And it does have Danny Houston playing Orson Welles in it. And it's basically a murder mystery set while Orson Welles was making Black Magic in Rome. I haven't seen the film yet, but I am acquiring a copy of it, and I'm going to have a lot of fun watching it. It only gets about a 5.5 on IMDb, and in fact, Black Magic itself only gets a 6.6. But I do want to watch it because I find that very, very interesting. Now, I probably should tell you something of the plot of this film. Now, the plot we have on Wikipedia isn't quite accurate, and I'll explain where it's not accurate. But anyway, Alexandre Dumas Sr., Barry Kroger, tells his son Alexandre Dumas Jr., Raymond Burr, the story of Joseph Balsamo. Through flashbacks, we learn that Balsamo was a French gypsy boy who endured much hardship. He was tortured under the command of the Vicomte de Montaigne, Stephen Bacassi, and his parents were ordered to hang. Some years later, he learns the secrets of hypnotism from Dr. Mesmer, Charles Gouldner. He doesn't actually, but he has it enhanced. Ignoring the doctor's advice that he uses his powers for healing, he exploits his new town to the full, gaining wealth, fame, and prestige. After changing his name to Count Cagliostro, he becomes famous all over Europe. Things begin to go downhill when he enters into a plot to substitute a young girl called Lorenza, Nancy Guild, for the French Queen Marie Antoinette, assisted by gypsies Gitano, Akim Tamarov, and Zoraida, played by Valentina Cortese. So that's basically it. He has this plot to substitute an identical person for Marie Antoinette and thereby gain power because this girl, Lorenza, has been mesmerized by Count Cagliostro into doing his bidding and, in fact, into marrying him. So this is one of those movies where hypnosis is used as a rape-assisting thing. And Cagliostro is not a character to be trusted in any way. But it wasn't made on an enormously large budget, which doesn't really work against it because Orson Welles is a centerpiece here and he's interesting and mesmerizing and fascinating as Cagliostro there. It's a minor role for him and it came just around, just before his famous Harry Lime in The Third Man. And so there are little bits of Harry Lime in Count Cagliostro. There's a bit where he dips his head down and does a cheeky smile, which is exactly like that first scene where you see Harry Lime in The Third Man. And Welles in this film is really great. He's lost some weight. He was using diet pills and dexedrine to do this. That's how they did it in those days, particularly if you were an actor. What you basically did was you took amphetamines until you were skinny. Then, of course, your weight would bounce back when you stopped taking amphetamines. In the meantime, you were making bad judgments and losing sleep and needing to take sleeping pills, and it all became a vicious cycle. It's not really recommended by doctors that you do things this way. But Welles is looking quite good in this film and healthy and fit and charismatic. You can understand why he was such a famous coxman at the time and had numerous affairs. In fact, according to Barbara Leeming's book, while he was making Black Magic in Italy, Welles was having an affair with a gypsy woman. This is the story anyway. And of course, this came from Welles, so the reliability of the matter is arguable. And Welles told Leeming that he learned how to steal chickens from a gypsy woman. The only problem being, of course, the only way to steal a live chicken at a marketplace is to hide it under your skirts because the wings flap and you know, hide it under some long skirts. And it's going to be less noticeable that you've got a chook jammed between your legs. But that's a story that Welles told Leeming and she reports it as fact in the book. But I like this film for a lot of reasons, one of which is I like the fact that there's a lot of actors that you don't see in other movies. A lot of them were European actors and their voices were dubbed, but they looked right for the parts. They had the kind of faces and the attitudes and the acting that was right for all of these people in France at the time. There are some ugly-looking gypsies, there are some nasty-looking guards, there are all sorts of interesting faces in this film, which is a lot of fun. I like the fact that there are so few films of Welles as the shyster and as the trickster and as the magician. And in this one, he does get to do sleight of hand with some beads and things like that. He does a stage act at the start of the film where Balsamo is selling basically snake oil. and doing magic tricks with putting people into coffins on the stage and then having them go between the two sarcophagi. And there's all those kind of little bits of business, which, even though the film isn't fantastic, does really add to it and fill out the time and fill out the film in a nice way. Now, Balsamo, aka Cagliostro, has been played by a whole bunch of different people in the history of cinema, which is kind of cool and very, very interesting. In fact, one of the most interesting people who played Count Cagliostro in a movie was in The Affair of the Necklace in 2003. He was played by Christopher Walken. I haven't seen that movie, and now I'm going to have to see it. It's one of those things where you watch this stuff, and then suddenly you really do have to go back and look at other films to understand. In fact, in 2003, he was also played by Robert Englund, who played Freddy Krueger. Nicole Williamson played him in Spawn in 1997. Jean Marais, the French actor, played him in Cagliostro in Louis in 1978. Howard Vernon, The Erotic Rites of Frankenstein, 1972. So Cagliostro did get around. And then, of course, there's The Castle of Cagliostro, the Studio Ghibli movie, Lupin the Third. One of the great things about Cagliostro is it's all to do with mysticism and ancient knowledge and things like that. And there was talk around that Cagliostro didn't actually die and that he found the secret to eternal life and all kinds of things like that. It's all tied up with that 18th and 19th century mysticism, which is so much fun when you see it in particularly French movies. And it is nice to see these interstitial movies of Orson Welles as well. It sits right between The Lady from Shanghai and The Third Man, and it's a period piece unlike those two movies, and he's not playing the naive sailor in it, nor is he playing the black marketeer in as he does in The Third Man, but he's kind of sitting in the middle there. A number of years ago, I did F for Fake in the podcast and talked about Welles as a showman and as a charlatan, and that whole movie, F for Fake, just to remind people in case they haven't listened to that podcast, is a magic trick of sorts and is a con trick of sorts and is Welles at his most playful. And there's an aspect of that to black magic as well, watching Welles be playful even though he's doing nasty things to people and mesmerizing innocent girls and trying to replace the Queen of France with a substitute and trying to con the French aristocracy. In fact, the French aristocracy try to pull a trick on Cagliostro in this film. There's a really nice scene where they bring in a whole bunch of diseased and ill beggars in filthy rags into court and then tell Cagliostro to cure them. And just as he's about to start curing them, as he did that nobleman who had the palsy, they all start standing up straight and dancing minuets, and he finds out that they were trying to con him and were pulling a prank on him because he was an upstart gypsy guy, he wasn't of the nobility. And so they try to pull a prank on him, but he turns it around and actually shows the abilities he has as a mesmerist in a very interesting way in that scene. And, of course, Welles chews up the scenery doing that. The movie I picked up for $10 at this kind of remaindered video shop, and I hadn't seen it for a very long time and remembered absolutely nothing about it. But I really did enjoy it. I found the period aspects of it fun. I found the kind of leaner and more dynamic Welles, a very interesting actor in there. And I liked the relationships that he formed with Akim Tamarov. This was the first movie they did together, and he ended up being in four of Welles' productions over the years. And they did have a great fondness for each other. But anyway, there's not too much else to say about Black Magic. You really should see it. It's a lot of fun, and people have seen all of the big high points of Welles' career, and to see the movies that he did for the money, and of course this one was purely for the money. He didn't have any skin in the game as far as production credits, even though he did direct some scenes. Somebody came on set during one of the action scenes with the crowds and a whole mob there, and Welles is standing on top of a chair directing the filming, and people go, well, where's Gregory Radoff, the guy who's supposed to be directing this film? And Wells looks around and points down to him, and Grigory Radov's down there in a costume playing one of the people in the mob scene, just for the fun of it. Wells did do some of the directing on this film. But leaving that aside, he didn't have any skin in the game, really, in this movie. Purely did it for the money, but you can tell that he did make an effort. It wasn't just a check-cashing exercise for Orson Welles in this film. He had a lot of fun with it. He got to show some things that, of which he was fond, the magic and the mysticism and that beautiful hypnotic voice combined with the mesmeric stare that Orson Welles had. And, it's a good, honest piece of cinema. And a lot of fun for that. And it does fill in one of the gaps in the history of one of the most interesting movie makers of the 20th century. So I'm going to take another break now. When I get back, we're going to talk about another film, about actors, in fact. The 1959 movie, partly written by Dalton Trumbo, one of the people who was blacklisted, starring Tony Franciosa and Dean Martin. It's the 1959 film Career.
All right, let me straighten you out. The Actors' Rostrum is a group that's going to put on not only one play, but a lot of plays. We're getting the nucleus of a company together right now. That's what these interviews are for. So, what have you done? It matters. I don't go by that, what you've done, baloney. Anyway, it's what you're going to do that counts, right?
Yes, I would
now,
say...
Now, we're going to do a lot of things. Chekhov, Pirandello, O'Neill, Kaufman, Hart, new plays. The pay is nothing per week, but it's a showcase, and a good one. Every producer and agent in New York City is going to come down here because the plays I direct are going to be brilliant. I like your look. Any questions?
Just one.
Shoot.
During performances, will I talk or will I just move my lips while you stand backstage and say the words?
You asked a question, now I'll ask one. We need backers. You got anything to invest? What's your answer to that?
So long.
Hey, fella, wait a minute.
Okay, so that's a clip from Career at the start where Sam Lawson meets Maury Novak, played by Dean Martin, in a very run-down little actor space in the wrong end of New York. So Tony Franciosa plays Sam Lawson, an aspiring actor who, after World War II, moves from Lansing, Michigan to New York to further his career. His fiancée, Barbara, is left behind but follows him to New York a year later. Meanwhile, Sam has joined the Actors' Rostrum, a fringe theatre group put together by Maury Novak, played by Dean Martin, who, as you can hear, is a hustling director. Sam's assisted by his agent Shirley, played by Carolyn Jones, and the story covers about a dozen years of his life. His marriage to Barbara, his second marriage to an ex-girlfriend of Maury's, Sharon, played by Shirley MacLaine, and the impact of the blacklist on both his and Maury's lives and careers. He suffers setbacks, divorce, personal and professional, betrayal, and is challenged in both his faith and his talent and his integrity as a human being. Now, I like this. This is one of those movies that I saw many years ago, a small film. I saw it on TV, no fanfare, and really, it's one of those films where you think, geez, this is pretty good. Why don't I know about it? It's one of the movies that wasn't made on a large budget. It wasn't made by a big director. The studio let Dean Martin do it because they had a contract with him and he wanted to start doing interesting things. This is remembered in the same bunch of years where he did things like Rio Bravo and Some Came Running with Frank Sinatra, when Dean Martin really wanted to prove his actor's chops because he'd broken up the partnership with Jerry Lewis and people thought he was just a good-looking, singing, straight guy. Straight guy in the comedic sense, not straight guy in the heterosexual sense, because he was very much that too. But Martin really had something to prove, and it was roles like this one and in Some Came Running, as I said, Rio Bravo and a few other movies where he really did prove that he was a good actor. After that, he kind of cashed checks and did the things he wanted to do and did the Matt Helm movies in the 1960s and did a lot of Las Vegas work. Had his own very successful TV show for a number of years where he just basically took things easy and did what he had to. But by then, he had proved his point that he was a fine actor. He didn't particularly have the burning passion to keep telling people repeatedly that he was a good actor, But he'd proved his point and he moved on to the things he wanted to do with his life. And more credit to him than that. All of the stuff I've seen for Greer emphasizes Dean Martin and Shirley MacLaine, which is really stupid because Tony Franciosa is the core of the movie as Sam. Now, Franciosa was an interesting actor. He started out on Broadway in a play. He did a play called A Hat Full of Rain, and he got a Tony Award for it. It was a supporting role. It was a secondary role, but he got a Tony Award for it. He got nominated for an Oscar for the movie version of Hat Full of Rain in 1957. He was also in another movie I've talked about on Paleo Cinema many years ago, being a face in the crowd with Andy Griffith, Lee Remick, and Patricia Neal. And probably the silliest role he did at this stage was in The Long Hot Summer, where he's playing a Southern gentleman with Paul Newman and Orson Welles. See, everything comes around. Orson Welles in the last movie. Orson Welles did a movie with Anthony Franciosa. It's all linked up. But in the 1960s, he did a lot of TV work and some movies. I remember he was in Fathom with Raquel Welch, which was a kind of spy spoof thing in the 60s. He did a few other things. In the 60s and 70s, he did a lot of TV work. He was in The Name of the Game with Gene Barry and Robert Stack. And so, like his character Sam Lawson in this, Franciosa was a jobbing actor. I've read a few things about Franciosa. I've been doing a little bit of deeper research than I usually do. And he did have a nasty temper in most of his career, and so he lost opportunities because of that. He started out pretty big. He actually worked as a waiter while he was studying at the Actors Studio, and that's one of the things that Sam Lawson in the movie Career does, is works as a waiter to make ends meet in between acting gigs. And then he had the great fame in the mid-1950s with The Hat Full of Rain and a few other things. But from all I can read, his abrasive personality kind of lost him those opportunities, which is a bit of a shame. He was interviewed later in life. He had a very happy third marriage. His first marriage was to Shelley Winters, and that ended in the mid-late 1950s. But his last marriage apparently was very happy, and he got some help. He got some therapy and kind of came to terms with himself. Just as his career was ending, he made peace with himself. And I always like to find that. I like redemption stories. I like the fact that people eventually, in some cases, and people for whom I have a lot of goodwill as actors, I like them when they get their shit together, whether it's when I've seen them on the screen or after I've seen them on the screen. It's something that I find really promising. The last thing I've seen Tony Franciosa and I was a bit surprised to see him in this, was a 1996 film called City Hall, starring Al Pacino, John Cusack, and Bridget Fonda. He does a little bit as a mafia guy in that, and it's only one bit, it's only a couple of scenes, and he's very, very good in it. He's very chilling, he's very good. There's a lot in what he says between the lines. I'm going to have to rewatch that movie just for that. Yes, I'm the sort of person that watches movies just for one scene. What the hell? I've got a bit of lifespan left. I might as well use it. But, I did enjoy seeing Franciosa in that and seeing him go back to his original acting chops. He had a great intensity as an actor when he allowed himself to. And that does come out in Sam Lawson in Career. And I think he's still... It was one of his earlier movie roles. I think he's still carrying a little bit of that stage presence about it, which means he could be a little bit large for the movie screen in a sense, as if he's trying to project to the back rows of a theatre audience. But allowing for that kind of slight criticism, I think he's very good in this movie. And a lot of the other, there are some nice other actors in this film as well. People who are like Shirley MacLaine's in it, and she was a great friend of Dean Martin's and Sammy Davis Jr.'s and Frank Sinatra's at the time, and was starting her career. This is just before she did The Apartment for Billy Wilder. And her character arc and her character in this is an interesting one. She starts out as a kind of drunk society girl and has a character arc as the... as life basically beats the shit out of her. And it's a little bit sad. And her, at the end of the film, you see a totally different character than you do for her at the start of the film, which has a certain ugliness and a certain reality about it. This movie does say some things about acting and about theatre and about the life that you have to lead to be an actor, which aren't always the kind of sugar-coated things that Hollywood has previously said about this particular chosen profession. But allowing for that, she's very good in the film as well. The first wife is played by an actress called Joan Blackman, who didn't do a hell of a lot of things after that, and she's not too bad in it as well. I don't think she's the strongest female role in it. That belongs to somebody else. But she does have a really nice scene towards the end of the film where after many years after they separated, her and Sam meet up unexpectedly. And that's kind of cool because she gives him something that he needs at the time. Barbara comes back into his life very, very briefly. And there's a grace note there that sets him on a trajectory he needs to go on. I'm not going to do a spoiler of it because I think it's a very nice scene. And it's very well played by both Joan Blackman and Tony Franciosa in that. The person who I like most in the film, among the female characters, is Shirley Drake, played by Carolyn Jones. Everyone knows Carolyn Jones from having played Morticia in the Addams Family. But she was a very gifted actor, and she, in this one, she really is the heart of the film. She plays what would have been called in those days, and of course, is we know better now, but would have been called a spinster character. She lives with her mother and some cats at the start of the film. She's in a very small office. She's a theatrical agent. She knows the business pretty well, and she knows what's required to be in the business. So she's got a certain worldly wisdom, and yet she's also a vulnerable character. There's a multiple dimensions there, which are partly in the writing, but are mostly in the way Carolyn Jones plays it. And she and Sam have a long-term business relationship and friendship. It's not it's not a romantic relationship, at least from 99% of the film. But there is a lovely rapport between Tony Franciosa and Carolyn Jones in their scenes together. And like a lot of the relationships in this film, the film does a marvellous job of showing the evolution of friendships and the evolution of relationships up and down, all the different ways that they go. And that's one of the things I like about it. The film's also got a very subtle way of portraying the passage of time. There's some little side things that people talk about, some things you see in the background give us the progress of time from, say, 1945. We'll assume it's up to about 1959. And the things that Sam and the other characters go through during that time. Now, one of the big focuses of this film is the blacklist and the effect that had on people who were totally unrelated to any communist subversion and things like that. And one of the reasons this is a strong point in this film is the script was written, amongst other people, by Dalton Trumbo, who himself was blacklisted and then had to work under pseudonyms for a dozen years because of that. Trumbo, having lived this, has some things to say about it which are quite interesting. There's a conversation between Mori, who ran the theatre company and who did join the party in the 1930s, did join the Communist Party, and between Mori and Sam, where Sam asks him whether he was a communist. He said, sure I was. It was a good career move at the time. I didn't really believe anything, but I thought I'd get some advantage out of it. And there were a number of people like that who joined for selfish and career reasons because it'd get them closer to somebody they needed to have some kind of a relationship with to further their career. But Sam's kind of collateral damage in it, because he worked at the Actors Rostrum, which was run by Mori, who was a member of the Communist Party, he suddenly, with no fanfare and no formality, appeared on the blacklist, a list that nobody actually claims to have seen, but everybody knew who was on it. And he has to go back to being a waiter for a time because of that until he gets some roles in the theatre. And that's... even though it's not as hard a sell as something like The Front, the movie Woody Allen's in The Front, it still, for its time, does go to talk about the blacklist and talk about the fact that some of the people who are on the blacklist were people who essentially were innocent, had done nothing wrong, who were just living their lives, doing their careers, had nothing to do with anything political, and yet were impacted enormously by this horrible and prejudicial thing that was spawned by the House Un-American Activities Committee. And Trumbo, it wasn't played as hard as it might have been in a later film, but it's definitely there, and it's definitely something where Trumbo does make his point. There are a couple of other scriptwriters on there, but they're not anybody who's done anything major. So what I'd suggest is the possibility that Trumbo did the script and then other people tweaked it afterwards. But yeah, it's the first Hollywood film that really addressed the blacklist as a negative thing and as something that impacted people's lives in a significant way. And all credit to her for that. It wasn't until a year later when Spartacus came out that Trumbo could speak under his own name or be credited under his own name, sorry. So, yeah, even though this movie could be looked at as just an ordinary drama, there are things underneath it which are quite important and quite important to remember as well. As things get a little nastier in life and a little nastier, particularly in political life, and being an Australian, I'm very aware of that at the moment with the government we have, it's good to remember that policies that we're told are for our benefit can have significant and negative impact on people's lives. I mean, there have been times in my life when I've been affected by political decisions that were made. When the previous Conservative government came in, the whole department I worked for, something like 15,000 people, was destroyed and cancelled by the government because of ideological reasons. So I'm very aware of the fact that politics and personal lives are something that are not separate. They're something that are intertwined, and one can strangle the other in a lot of ways. So, Carrera is a good film. It does show, I mean, Sam's not an unalloyed nice character. He's somebody who's driven and who must do this and has an enormous passion for the theatre and an enormous passion for acting. But there are times during the course of the movie where he does things, you go, oh shit, don't do that. There are those kind of moments in it where he takes advantage of things when he finds out something that is incredibly painful to him but can be turned to his advantage. And there are times when he's blind to the needs of others and that kind of thing. So it's a really nice movie in the sense that even the protagonist is not a nice character all the time. And ultimately he does get success in his career in some ways, but the prices are very high that he pays. Interestingly, Carrera was directed by a guy called Joseph Anthony, who was an actor as well as a director, and who won a couple of Tony Awards for directing on the New York stage in the middle of the 1950s. He didn't direct a lot of films. He did this one, Carrera, The Rainmaker, with Catherine Hepburn and Burt Lancaster from 1956, which is quite interesting, and The Matchmaker with Shirley Booth in 1958. So he didn't have a long career in Hollywood, but because he had such extensive stage experience as a director, the stage stuff really does ring true in this movie, and it really does add something to the way the world of the theatre is portrayed in Carrera. And I think that's a movie that I like for a number of reasons. I like it because of that fact that it's got a 15-year arc and it tells a lot of story in just a 90-odd minute running time, which is kind of cool. And there are even some small roles that are kind of interesting. Donna Douglas turns up playing a friend from the town that Sam grew up in, along with an actor called Jerry Paris, who also did a lot of directing on television. He was in the Dick Van Dyke Show. But Donna Douglas is in there playing somebody very unlike her kind of iconic role of Ellie Mae Clampett in the Beverly Hillbillies. And you get to see the fact that, yes, she was an actor who could play more than just an embarrassing redneck stereotype, but wasn't given the opportunity to. And the other thing you can see in that shows that is there's an episode of The Twilight Zone called Eye of the Beholder where she shows her acting chops as well. But, it was interesting. It wasn't a big part in this movie, but it's nice to see actors who, for obvious, you've got to put bread on the table for reasons, do take roles that don't showcase their best skills. But it's good to see them in roles outside that too. It's one of the lovely things about being a movie buff, to see those little roles. And that also harks back to Anthony Franciosa in City Hall, seeing an actor that you like a lot in a later role where he just nails it perfectly. And in that case, in a very sinister way. That's one of the extra joys of being a film buff. So definitely see Career if you get the opportunity. It is around. It has been released on DVD and does turn up on television at times. And I think it's one of those movies that... Well, I'm a sucker for movies about movie making or movies about actors and things like that. And there are some bits done in Hollywood in this film as well. Set in Hollywood, sorry. But I really do like it. It's a good, honest piece of work. It's got some very fine acting in it, and it does say something about the history of entertainment in the middle of the 20th century, which are quite important lessons to remember. So I'm going to end it there for Career, and I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, there's a bit of feedback, and I'll just do another reminder about the Patreon thing, because everything I learned about this kind of stuff says you've got to keep saying things about it.
Hey, Swinger. The Swinger knows the way it's happening and where the actions are going to be. Well, and if there is a good thing, shit, the Swinger finds it naturally. Actual evidence tends to show the Swinger was a one and then a go, go, go. So keep your old routine and make the scene. Baby, come and swing with me. The Swinger only lives the good life. The time comes to very few. Well, if a Swinger hasn't doubt, it's cause too much trouble to do. Verified circumstance tends to say the Swinger was a one and then a yeah, yeah, yeah. If I can be your guest, I'll do the rest. Baby, let me swing with you. Come on along, let's put the world on. Come on along, let's make it move. Come on along, baby, get rid of it. Or get that old conventional groove. You're gonna see the way it's happening. Actions are gonna be. Well, and if there is a good thing, shame, you're gonna find it natural. Only experience shows you how the Swinger was a one and then a wowie wow. So do your old routine and make the scene. Baby, come and swing with me. Now, baby, come and swing with me.
That was Anne Margaret with the Swinger from the 1966 movie of the same name, which also starred Tony Franciosa. So it's on for the feedback. David Dietz sent me two messages regarding podcasts. Let's see. I'm not sure whether I've read this one out, so I'll read it out again. David said, P.S. It might be a touch late for feedback, but Rhea Aldo Ray, you might have given him short shrift. Have you seen Nightfall? I thought he was pretty good in that. Keep up the fantastic and fun work. Yeah, thanks for that, David. Yes, I have seen it now. I did watch Nightfall after you sent that to me again, and I'd forgotten it was a Jacques Tourneur film. And yeah, I got to agree, Aldo Ray was good in that. I think he was good in a couple of things. I know he was good in The Siege of Pinchgut, the film in my hometown of Sydney. And I think that maybe he's one of those actors too for whom alcohol diminished his talent. So a lot of the things we've seen him in weren't the best showcases for the man. So I will wear that one as, yes, Aldo Ray did have some chops as an actor, but unfortunately it wasn't always apparent. And David sent me another one as well. Another splendid show, and congratulations on pronouncing my name correctly. Barely anyone here in America does, though maybe it's not a surprise since you're a Francophile. As for this week's question, I must say my pick is Sabrina. I kind of came to Hepburn sideways by seeing They All Laugh first, but I'm also squeamish about seeing William Holden as a romantic lead. I know I'm probably wrong, but there's piles of stuff I need to watch first. Yep. Basically, I like William Holden. I like William Holden for a couple of reasons, one of which is he's got the same birthday as me. And that's a totally irrational and stupid, but very human reason for liking him. And I think that, again, he's like Aldo Ray. He's an actor whose talents diminish because of alcohol. But even diminished in things like Network is fantastic. I do really like him in that. And I like him in SOB. I think that may have been one of his last films. The Blake Edwards movie he does with a terrific ensemble of him, Robert Preston and Robert Webber. I've talked about SOB on a podcast before. I've also talked about another movie of William Holden's that I like a lot, which is Paris When It Sizzles, which he did with Audrey Hepburn. And that one maybe is a little more accessible. If you get a chance to have it, try Paris When It Sizzles. Yes, it's silly and the last end of it doesn't make a lot of sense, but it really is a groovy little film and a lot of fun, and it kind of deconstructs filmmaking in a nice way as well. So you might want to try that one out if you get an opportunity to. So, yeah, and thank you again for the feedback. It really is appreciated, and I like people who correct me when I'm wrong. Now, I did get an email from Mark Arlepa. Now, this is slightly tangential to the podcast. I recommended Newsfront as an Australian film people might want to look at. From the late 70s, I think it is, starring Bill Hunter and Wendy Hughes, who unfortunately died recently. And Mark says, you recommended Newsfront highly, so I was anxious to see it. I had not heard of it before. I put it on my Netflix queue only to discover it was running the same night on Turner Classic Movies. This month, Turner has been featuring Australian film. I really like the film that covers enough time that you can see the world changing over the course of the film. I missed some of the references to Australian national politics, but I did understand the comments on more international politics. It was also my introduction to Wendy Hughes, whom I found a very watchable actress. As it happened, I'd recorded Lonely Hearts that same night, so I was able to see her in a slightly less glamorous role. I'd probably like to see more of her work. Sadly, I see that she died in March. Anyway, thanks again for recommending Newsfront. Yeah, Wendy Hughes did a lot of good stuff. She was one of those actors who could play working class and could play posh, and really she had a stage career as well. She had a long stage career here in Australia in various roles. I know she did Ibsen and other things like that. So she was a good actor, and in Newsfront and a couple of other films, particularly one called Peterson, which may be called Jock Peterson in America. She's very good in that, and for those who are interested, she does get undressed in that film as well. So, yeah, Newsfront I really will have to do for the podcast. I know I've done it for the radio gig, and I got a good response when I did that. But I really should do it for the podcast and expand on why I think Newsfront's one of the best Australian films of all time. Anyway, I'm going to end it there. This has been an unusual one because of the Patreon thing. And while I've been recording the podcast, I did it over 2 days. I did some of it yesterday and some of it today. I've got more subscribers to the Patreon thing, which is really lovely. I've got a few different ones, which is kind of cool and groovy and lovely. And some friends have done it, and people I don't know have done it. So again, if you go to Patreon, patreon.com/paleocinema, lowercase, one word, no dash, you can have a look at it and see if it is something you want to do. I'm not going to go further than that because I gushed about it at the start of the podcast. Anyway, whether you are a patron of the podcasting arts and donate money or not, I love the fact that you're listening. I love the fact that we're sharing stuff about movies here. So I'm going to be back in 2 weeks with another couple of films. And I'm going to be back in a week with the Martian Drive-In podcast, which you can find out about over at marsdrivein.blogspot.com. This campaign's for everything, by the way, for both podcasts. But look after yourselves. I'll be back soon. And I am enjoying this gig so much that I can't express it. I really love talking about movies. And the thing that really did it for me and refreshed me a lot isn't this Patreon business. It's the fact that I went and talked to people at Continuum. And we're talking about podcasts. We're talking about sharing knowledge and sharing a passion of the things you love and how very important that is for people to do as a community. We did it. We shared information and shared knowledge and shared stories around fires in caves thousands of years ago. We did it in the plains of Africa when we were living there. We did it in all sorts of different environments around the world, and it's one of the things that joins us together as a species. So just on that note, there are a few podcasts I've got to name check and recommend. The big one is Galactic Suburbia. If you're into science fiction books, Galactic Suburbia is the place to go. Just type that into a search engine and you'll find it. Tansy, who is one of the supporters of this podcast, is one of the trio who do Galactic Suburbia. There's, of course, the B-movie cast with Vince Rotolo. There's A Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema with Big Willie and the Samurai. There is Dr. Zom and Piccolo over at Silver and Gold. There's Love That Album with Morris. There are a whole bunch of other ones. I'm going to have to do a more complete list next time, but definitely go with them. One of the things I am enjoying, which is a more professional podcast, is Scott Aukerman's Comedy Bang Bang. You might want to look at that. And WTF with Mark Maron if you want a couple of professional podcasts to listen to. Anyway, that's about it. This was written and produced by Terry Frost. The Foley artist is Tansy Rayner Roberts. And the continuity girl is Julia Hilton. So thank you very much, and I'll be back in 2 weeks' time.